Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, this is a great honor for me. I've looked forward to it for a long time. To play this part in an historic occasion as we begin this task of selecting our Republican nominee for President of the United States. And tonight we are gathered here at the 31st Republican National Convention. As a party that wears the scars of combat, but as a party completing a contest for its presidential nomination among the most intense in the history of this country. And yet, my friends, as a party in fighting trim, sobered by its losses and toughened by its battles, and determined to work together and to win together in November of 1976. My friends, this is a time as well for straight talk. For straight talk and common sense. For common sense talk about the condition of our party. For straight talk about the needs of our nation. These have been difficult times, difficult years for the Republican Party. The Watergate era was a painful time for all of us. You know that. And certainly I know that. And some in our party have gone through a crisis of faith, even wondering if the Republican Party had the strength to survive and to go forward. But we do. My friends, we do have that strength because we faced our problems. We faced our problems with honor and dignity. We performed as the country would expect us to perform. We didn't shy away from our duty in the face of difficult times, even though we knew that one embarrassing, a humiliating, even a potentially devastating time. And indeed, Republicans took a real drubbing in the elections of 1964, in part, at least because of that unhappy time in our national experience. But you know, since then, America's learned a lot about other political abuses in prior Democratic administrations and even in the present Democratic Congress. Abuses of personal liberty, invasions of privacy, and political mischief of the most shocking type. But friends, there's one big difference. We faced ours. And in doing so, we raised the country's expectations for honorable government in the United States. But we're still waiting for the Democrats to face theirs this year in 1976. But you know, it's interesting in that view to watch the Democrats running around the country, rattling the dusty old skeletons of Watergate all over again. But they can rattle those skeletons until the bones fall out, and it's not going to work. And let me tell you why. Because the issues in 1976 are Republican issues. And because the Republican record in 1976 is one that we can be proud to run on and one we deserve to win on this year. Because Republicans are looking to the future of this country while the Democrats are still chasing the ghosts of the past. So, to those in the opposition who day after day try to exploit the tragedy of Watergate for partisan purposes and who pretend that one party or one person has had a monopoly on mistake or bad judgment, I say, you know better, they know better, and the people of the United States know better, and let's set the record straight now, tonight. My friends, let's put away past history. Let's put aside hypocrisy. And in this election, let's talk about what does divide the parties in 1976. And let's make Jimmy Carter level with the American people before the election exactly what he proposes to do with the government after the election. Well, friends, you know, the issue this year isn't virtue. It isn't love or patriotism or compassion. These are common concerns of all of us, regardless of party. The issue this year, quite simply, is this. The issue this year is this. How much government is too much government? How many laws are too many laws? How much taxation is too much taxation? How much coercion is too much coercion? Those are the issues in 1976. And friends, that's what the election this year is all about, and we're not going to let Jimmy Carter forget about it. You know, as we look at America today, as we look at this great country of ours, in this era we find challenges to match our strengths, but we also find strengths in America to match those challenges. And today we have greater economic strength, greater scientific and technological strength than any nation, anytime, anywhere. And let's not forget the source of that strength. It's not the government. It has never been the government. It's the people of the country who provide that strength, the people of America. And it's through the free will of a free people that we will continue to build that strength. After the worst recession of the post-war period, our economy is in a healthy, solid recovery, with jobs up, with incomes up, with inflation down, and it's recovering because the Republican administration had the courage when it counted to stand up against a free-spending Democratic Congress. And it's happening because the Republican administration has the courage to veto reckless spending and to resist the clamorous calls for rationing in peacetime. Abroad, we face new challenges. We face the challenge of growing military might in the Soviet Union, from heightened economic competition throughout the world, and from international terrorism abroad throughout the land. From the advance of communist parties in the countries of our friends in Western Europe, we confront the danger of nuclear proliferation, of a continuing conflict in the Middle East and ferment in Africa and Asia and Latin America. And what this means is that the world continues to be a dangerous place, as it has been a dangerous place for generations. And it means that the United States must go forward with a sure tread and a clear instinct for where the dangers lie. The question confronting America this year, the questions are serious. And my friends, they require serious choices. They demand that each of us think carefully about the direction America must take, about the careful decisions we must make in these critical years ahead. And this presents a challenge to the two-party system itself. My friends, throughout history, America has been remarkably right on the major decisions that have confronted her. Not only because we have always had great leaders, because certainly we have had our share, but primarily because the people's judgment and wisdom, the common sense of America, has often supplied those answers to the great dilemma that confront America. And the two-party system in the United States has served us well as the sensing mechanism by which the common sense of America has been determined. And if we are to meet the challenges of the future, if we are to avert the perils and fully realize on our promise, we must continue to hearken to the common sense of this nation, to those shared perceptions, those basic ideas that reflect the popular wisdom and embody the national will. 2 centuries ago, the founding fathers spoke the common sense of America when they declared that all men are created equal, and that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the governed. In the days that saw the birth of the Republican Party, it was the common sense of America to put an end to slavery and to bind up the wounds of a divided nation. In our time, the common sense of America was that we should join with our allies in defeating Nazi tyranny. It was the common sense of America to stand firm against Soviet expansion. It was the common sense of America to help those in need and to right the wrongs against blacks and other Americans who've been the victims of discrimination for too long. It is the common sense of America. It is the common sense of America to make government a creative instrument for doing together those things that we cannot do separately. At one critical turning point after another, it has been the popular wisdom, the good common sense of the people themselves that has been the nation's salvation. And that is why those who best keep faith with the common sense of America best keep faith with the people of America. My friends, that is why the party that understands and responds to the common sense of America can best be expected to do what is right for our nation and for the world. Fellow Republicans, the common sense of America today is that even a freely elected government can become an oppressive government. The common sense of America today is that government taxes too much, it meddles too much, it interferes too much, it bullies too much, and it's up to us to do something about it at the polls in November of 1976. And because this is the common sense of America, the Democratic Party has four big problems this year, my friends. And the first of those problems is Jimmy Carter. And the second one of those big problems that our friends the Democrats have is Walter Mondale. And the third big problem the Democrats have in 1976 is that Democratic Congress. And my friends, the fourth big problem they got is the American people. They don't want the kind of government they'd get from a cozy alliance between another big spending Congress and a Carter Mondale administration in 1976. You know which party it is that speaks the common sense of America. Party, as it has been for more than 100 years in this country. Republican Party, which fought uphill battles to limit the size of government, to limit the role of government, to protect the individual against the encroachments of government. And we say to you, America, we hear you and we understand what you want in 1976. The idea of limited government is one that we didn't suddenly embrace when it became popular, but one that we preached when it was unpopular. We preached it because we shared the concern of Thomas Jefferson, who warned his countrymen that the natural process of things is for liberty to yield and for government to gain ground. We preach it because our aim is not the sullen calm of a regimented society, but the mutual respect of a free society. And we preach it also, my friends, because we believe in it and we practice it. And Jimmy Carter says he will never lie to us. But my friends, Jimmy Carter is the nominee of the party that gave us the original credibility. And the Jimmy Carter who talks about running against Washington is the nominee of the party which created more than 1,000 new federal programs and planned them so poorly that they've made Washington sound like a dirty word. At last month's Democratic convention, Carter made it clear in his platform and his acceptance speech that the same old tired approaches will be tried again this year. While he still bobs and weaves and straddles a lot of issues, it's now clear that the part of Carter Mondale politics will be more of the same. More programs, more promises, more controls, more spending, more taxes, more government. That's the Carter Mondale program. And we've been down that road, my friends, and we've seen where it goes. We've been down that road, and don't you let them take us down it again in 1976. Democratic Party has been in control of the Congress of the United States. And you know, in those 44 years, federal spending has risen from less than $4 billion annually to upwards of $400 billion annually. And when it comes to big government, you know, Franklin Roosevelt always was thought of as the founder of big government in the United States. But based on the record of that Democratic Congress, Jimmy Carter and his friends in Congress make Franklin Roosevelt look like a piker by comparison. Just think about this for just a second. It was pointed out to me the other day that in this year alone, the Democratic Congress is spending more of your money than it spent in the entire year of the Roosevelt New Deal, and that even includes the cost of World War II. And if the promises of the Carter-Mondale platform were enacted into law, as you've been told previously, it would add at least another $110 billion on top of that. And that is the equivalent of another $2,000 of taxes for every family of four in the United States of America. You know, in some of their campaign speeches, some of our Democratic friends and candidates began to sound a little like Republicans, running against big government, talking about the limitations of power. A while that sounded awful Republican to me, and I was tickled to death. But you know, after they got to New York, they got to their convention, we found out they still acted like Democrats. And while they were trying to sing our song, as Ronald Reagan once said, I guess they learned words, but they never learned how to carry the music. Friends, it was the same old thing. The same old reflex actions were still there. Just look at the Democrats' platform. Plank after plank says, pass another law. Spend another billion. Build a new bureaucracy. You know, when you tote up the dollars and you think of the proposals that the Democrats are making for more and more of poor government, it reminds me a little of what my late father-in-law used to say, the late and I think great Everett McKinley Dirksen, by the way. Ev Dirksen's daughter was an only child. She's my wife, and I tell her she only acts like it sometimes. She's up there on the platform with me. But, you know, when Dirksen would think about a free-spending Democratic Congress, he used to say, why a billion here and a billion there? And why, my friends, the first thing you know, it ends up the real money. First, just a question of money. You know, it's not just money we're concerned about as Republicans in this election year. It's a question of what kind of country we're going to have. And somehow, the Democratic words of compassion always seem to translate into programs of coercion, of control, of compulsion. My friend, power in Washington is a seductive thing. Power to tax, the power to spend, the power to regulate, the power of a few hundred people in Congress to impose their own will on 200 million others. And it often breeds a sort of insensitivity to the limits of power. And this year's campaign is not just a question of ins and outs, not just a question of who gets the power, but more importantly, how that power is going to be used. Whether it's going to be used to restrain the growth of government or to accelerate the growth of government. That's the big difference between the Republican and Democratic parties in this election year. Difference on how much power the government should have and how that power should be exercised. The Democrats start with government, and we start with people. My friends, for decades now, leaders of the Democratic Party have peddled the patronizing notion that only in Washington are officials wise enough or far-sighted enough to decide for the rest of us what our priorities should be, how we should spend our taxes, what our goals should be, how we should organize our communities, even how close to home our children should go to school. And they do this with the best of intentions, because they really believe that they do know better, and that the rules and guidelines that they write are for our own good, that some superior vision, some nobler motive, entitles them to tell the rest of us how to run our personal lives. But let me tell you something. The notion that they know better what's best for Nashville or New York or for Kansas City is so much nonsense. They don't know better. You know better what's better for this country. That, my friend, and that is at the heart of the Republican idea. That the place to put our faith is in the people themselves. That government in Washington should legislate less and should listen more. For a long time now, it's been fashionable to praise that strong. Those administrations and those lawmakers who use their power to extend their power. But that fashion is wrong. And today, more and more people can see that it is wrong. And know that it takes even greater strength to stand against the temptation of power than it does to extend it. And to know that the government that really cares is the one that promises only what it can promote. We don't want the kind of government they'd get from a cozy alliance between another big spending Congress and a Carter Mondale administration in 1976. It is the fixed common sense of the American Party, as it has been for more than 100 years in this country. It's the Republican Party, which fought uphill battles to limit the size of government, to limit the role of government, to protect the individual against the encroachments of government. And we say to you, America, we hear you and we understand what you want in 1976. The idea of limited government is one that we didn't suddenly embrace when it became popular, but one that we preached when it was unpopular. We preached it because we shared the concern of Thomas Jefferson, who warned his countrymen that the natural process of things is for liberty to yield and for government to gain ground. We preach it because our aim is not the sullen calm of a regimented society, but the mutual respect of a free society. And we preach it also, my friends, because we believe in it and we practice it. And Jimmy Carter says he will never lie to us. But my friends, Jimmy Carter is the nominee of the party that gave us the original credibility. And the Jimmy Carter who talks about running against Washington is the nominee of the party which created more than 1,000 new federal programs and planned them so poorly that they've made Washington sound like a dirty word. At last month's Democratic convention, Carter made it clear in his platform and his acceptance speech that the same old tired approaches will be tried again this year. While he still bobs and weaves and straddles a lot of issues, it's now clear that the Carter-Mondale politics will be more of the same. More programs, more promises, more controls, more spending, more taxes, more government. That's the Carter-Mondale program. And we've been down that road, my friends, and we've seen where it goes. We've been down that road, and don't you let them take us down it again in 1976. My friends, it's no coincidence that for 40 years of the last 44, the Democratic Party has been in control of the Congress of the United States. And you know, in those 44 years, federal spending has risen from less than $4 billion annually to upwards of $400 billion annually. And when it comes to big government, you know, Franklin Roosevelt always was thought of as the founder of big government in the United States. But based on the record of that Democratic Congress, Jimmy Carter and his friends in Congress make Franklin Roosevelt look like a piker by comparison. Just think about this for just a second. It was pointed out to me the other day that in this year alone, the Democratic Congress is spending more of your money than it spent in the entire years of the Roosevelt New Deal, and that even includes the cost of World War II. And if the promises of the Carter-Mondale platform were enacted into law, as you've been told previously, it would add at least another $110 billion on top of that. And that is the equivalent of another $2,000 of taxes for every family of four in the United States of America. You know, in some of their campaign speeches, some of our Democratic friends and candidates began to sound a little like Republicans, running against big government, talking about the limitations of power, a while it sounded awful Republican to me. And I was tickled to death. But you know, after they got to New York, when they got to their convention, we found out they still acted like Democrats. And while they were trying to sing our song, as Ronald Reagan once said, I guess they learned the words, but they never learned how to carry the fuse. You know, my friends, it was the same old thing. The same old reflex actions were still there. Just look at the Democrats' platform. Plank after plank says, pass another law. Spend another billion. Build a new bureaucracy. You know, when you tote up the dollars and you think of the proposals that the Democrats are making for more and more of more government, it reminds me a little of what my late father-in-law used to say, the late and I think great Everett McKinley Dirksen, by the way. Ev Dirksen's daughter was an only child. She's my wife, and I tell her she only acts like it sometimes. She's up there on the platform with me. But, you know, when Dirksen would think about a free-spending Democratic Congress, he used to say, why a billion here and a billion there, and why, my friends, the first thing you know, it adds up to real money. Just a question of money. You know, it's not just money we're concerned about, Mr. Republicans, in this election year. It's a question of what kind of country we're going to have. And somehow, the Democratic words of compassion always seem to translate into programs of coercion, of control, of compulsion. My friend, power in Washington is a seductive thing. Power to tax, the power to spend, the power to regulate, the power of a few hundred people in Congress to impose their own will on 200 million others. And it often breeds a sort of insensitivity to the limits of power. And this year's campaign is not just a question of ins and outs, not just a question of who gets the power, but more importantly, how that power is going to be used. Whether it's going to be used to restrain the growth of government or to accelerate the growth of government. That's the big difference between the Republican and Democratic parties in this election year. Difference on how much power the government should have and how that power should be exercised. The Democrats start with government, and we start with people. My friends, for decades now, leaders of the Democratic Party have peddled the patronizing notion that only in Washington are officials wise enough or far-sighted enough to decide for the rest of us what our priorities should be, how we should spend our taxes, what our goals should be, how we should organize our communities, even how close to home our children should go to school. And they do this with the best of intentions, because they really believe that they do know better, and that the rules and guidelines that they write are for our own good, that some superior vision, some nobler motive, entitles them to tell the rest of us how to run our personal lives. But let me tell you something. The notion that they know better what's best for Nashville or New York or for Kansas City is so much nonsense. They don't know better. You know better what's better for this country. And that, my friend, and that is at the heart of the Republican idea. That the place to put our faith is in the people themselves. That government in Washington should legislate less and should listen more. For a long time now, it's been fashionable to praise as strong. Those administrations and those lawmakers who use their power to extend their power. But that fashion is wrong. And today, more and more people can see that it is wrong. And know that it takes even greater strength to stand against the temptations of power than it does to extend them. And to know that the government that really cares is the one that promises only what it can perform. That concerns itself with the next generation, not just the next election. And that moves forward one sure step at a time. Not by blind leaps that drain our resources and risk our future. And a government that truly cares is one that cares about all of the people, not merely as a coalition of interest groups, that cares about them individually, all of the people, one at a time. It is each American individually who knows the despair that comes when government fails, either because it does too little or because it attempts too much. It is written on the facade of the National Archives that what is past is prologue. And for a nation to survive, it must learn from its past. As we look back on our past, on the decade of the 60s, many of our memories are so painful. Of burning cities, of riots in the streets, the forces of law under siege, the sky shot full of promises sent aloft like Roman candles that lit the heavens with hope only to fizzle and disappear. But my friends, America has had its fling with Roman candles, with the exaggerated promise, the false expectation, the cruel deception that preyed most viciously on those most vulnerable, the young, the black, the jobless, the poor. With little to cling to except hope itself. And in New York last month from the Democratic Convention, we saw the same old Roman candle set off again. More promises, more impossible dreams, more gift certificates in the sky. But it's not going to fool the American people, not this time, because we're not going to let it happen to America. You know, we Republicans entered the election this year as a minority party. We know that. But you know, while I was watching the Democratic Convention on television from my home in Tennessee, when I saw them speaking of unifying the party and going on to victory, it suddenly dawned on me that the Democrats have omitted to realize that they're a minority party, too. And you know, it will be the voters of the United States this year, all of them. Republicans and Democrats, but more particularly that great body of independent spirit and citizens in the United States, who will vote with equal ease for a Republican or a Democratic candidate who will decide this election. So let the Democrats talk about uniting their party. Let them celebrate their victory in July. We'll celebrate ours in November. They can unite. New York and celebrate their victory in July. They can talk about uniting their party, and I got news for them. They can unite their party till they're blue in the face, and they'll get about 40% of the vote, and we'll get about 60%. Because, my friends, because it will be the whole country that will decide the outcome of this election. Republicans, enlightened Democrats, and those independents who really care about their country and who want to know what political parties have to offer. And you know, therein lies the great opportunity for our party, for Republicans. Because what we believe in this year, what the great majority of American people believe in this year, are Republican policies. And because for us, These are not policies of convenience. They are policies of conviction, which we fought for through lean years as well as the good. And that's why we can look forward with confidence and with pride to a Republican year in 1976. We know, and the country must know, that these are Republican principles that they're falling for, that they're crying out for effective government, that the people want effective government, that they want limited government. Because people in 1976 want restraint on the arrogance of power. Whether it's the arrogance of the executive, arrogance of the Congress, or arrogance of the court, the people want restraint on the arrogance of power in 1976. Because the people of this country want a nation with the strength to defend its vital interests and the wisdom to define them. Because the people want leadership that has a heart, but that uses its head. Because what we Republicans say to the people is, not trust me, but trust yourselves. My friends, in all history, no dream has exercised so powerful a hold on the human spirit as the American dream. No political experiment has so caught the hopes of mankind as the American experiment. For two centuries, ours has been a beacon of liberty that lit hope in the hearts of millions of people on every continent. For two centuries, from every corner of the globe, people have flocked to our shores. Their dreams, their strivings, their sacrifices have made America. And just as ours is the only nation whose people are drawn from every nation, we have a meaning that reaches the people of all nations. My friends, around the world today, the idea of freedom itself is on the defensive. But here in America, our American experiment is still unfolding. Our American adventure is still continuing. And our third century offers as much promise for the world as our first. On our shoulders, we carry the hopes of free men and women everywhere. As a nation, the responsibility we bear to the idea of freedom is a sacred trust. As a political party, the responsibility we bear to that same idea of freedom is an equally sacred trust. We shall be true to that trust, and by placing our faith firmly and unshakably in the people, we shall prove ourselves worthy of the trust we ask of the people. Thank you very much.